This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg. In Goliath, that is, Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel, Max Blumenthal takes us on a journey through Israel, Palestine, painting a startling portrait of Israeli society under the siege of increasingly authoritarian politics as the occupation of the Palestinians deepens. He tells the story of Israel in the wake of the collapse of the Oslo peace process. Through his far-ranging travels, Blumenthal illustrates the present by uncovering the ghosts of the past, the histories of Palestinian neighborhoods and villages now gone and forgotten, and how that history has set the stage for the current crisis.
Good to be on with you.
I want to begin by the comments of Congress member Charlie Rangel, who was down at City Hall, where there was a press conference that was termed really New York Stands with Israel. And his comments were categorically condemnative of the Palestinians, of Hamas, and went further and actually blamed Hamas and the Palestinians for the humanitarian crisis that has now presented itself in Gaza. What are your thoughts?
Well, Charlie Rangel needs to go home to one of his five rent-controlled apartments or to one of his Dominican Republic vacation retreats that he's paid for with his public slush fund, because his comments show us an out-of-touch figure who is siding with the kind of Jim Crow oppressors who have killed, 25% of those killed in the Gaza Strip are children. And Charlie Rangel is at City Hall to celebrate these killers and to celebrate the apartheid regime that's holding 1.7 million people in a human warehouse as surplus humanity. This is an appalling display by a figure who's portrayed himself as a defender of the little guy in New York, and it really is especially insulting to hear Charlie Rangel and Jerry Nadler, these self-styled progressives, attack those who are protesting them outside City Hall, including scores of Jewish Americans, as supporters of Hamas and members of Hamas. This is the kind of disgusting and dehumanizing rhetoric that is a bipartisan project in Washington.
I want to take it further, because for the last days, certainly, I have been barraged from the BBC through all the U.S. media, for example, by people such as the economy minister in Israel, Bennett, who says that really all that's being asked is that for Hamas, the people in Gaza, to lay down their weapons and that the attacks will stop. Again, your comments and thoughts on this, as they continue to say, as does Netanyahu, that essentially the Gazans are responsible for the deaths of their own people, using them effectively as human shields.
Yeah, well, the goal of the State of Israel since 1948 has been total Palestinian submission to their settler colonial imperatives. 80% of the people living in the Gaza Strip are refugees. That means that they or their relatives were kicked off their land by force and ethnically cleansed in 1947 and 1948 in order to produce a Jewish state with a Jewish demographic majority. The State of Israel has been engaged in violent demographic engineering for 66 years. The United States doesn't have a threshold of the white percentage of white Christians it seeks to maintain. Israel has a percentage at 70% of the Jewish demographic majority it seeks to maintain. It's an ethnocracy. And so the people of Gaza pay the price for the existence of a Jewish state. They are not allowed to return to their land. They're not able to really go anywhere. They're not even able to export goods from their businesses or fish in the Mediterranean beyond 3 kilometers from the Gaza coast, simply because they're not Jews. If they were Jews, the walls around the Gaza Strip, those electrified fences and cameras, would come down tomorrow. So they're basically human surplus who are being warehoused. And when people are treated that way, they start to organize and mobilize in a project of decolonization, because decolonization means their freedom. It means they're granted rights. And as we've seen throughout history, decolonization projects often take violent turns. The violence that we've seen from Palestinians in comparison to the violence of the Algerians or Black South Africans or Native Americans in successful and failed decolonization projects, I think, is characterized by restraint. It's comparatively less violent than those other struggles. But we've seen Hamas and other groups in the Gaza Strip, like Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and even secular groups, fire rockets at Israel. It's their only way of resisting. And Israel responds to the extent that it's responding at all. It often just attacks without provocation. With 500 to 2,000-pound bombs, Mads Gilbert, the Norwegian doctor, is at Al-Shifa Hospital right now, and he is reporting seeing injuries of children in the Gaza Strip and women and civilians from dime weaponry, dense inert metal explosives, an experimental weapon first tested by the State of Israel in 2008-2009 in the Gaza Strip, which causes the blood of its victims to implode by infusing it with tungsten. This is the kind of treatment that Charlie Rangel, of besieged and warehoused people who have been expelled and ethnically cleansed, that Charlie Rangel and Representative Jerry Nadler are defending. And the UN is documenting that over 80% of casualties in the Gaza Strip are civilians.
I wonder if you could talk about some of the events that led up to this catastrophe, especially the deaths of the three Israeli teenagers and the killing of Muhammad Abu Qadir. And I believe that his cousin is in detention right now.
Yeah.
If you could talk, I mean, that's not the only thing that's been going on, but it's sort of some of the most visible things.
Well, I mean, I provided the historical context, but the immediate context right now starts in May with the peace process collapsing, the U.S. blaming Netanyahu for the collapse of the peace process with promiscuous settlement authorization, the killing of Palestinian teens during a May 15th protest on closed-circuit TV and filmed by CNN, which put Netanyahu further on the defensive, and then the Fatah-Hamas reconciliation deal, which led to the first unity government we've ever seen between these two factions. All of this frustrated Netanyahu. He sought to reframe the discussion with the kidnapping of three Israeli teens by a rogue Hamas cell, apparently no knowledge from Hamas leadership, and a gambit that really contravened Hamas's political goals after signing this important reconciliation deal. Netanyahu sought to milk the propaganda, sought to milk this kidnapping for all it's worth. And as I've established, as Bob Mackey at the New York Times has established, as Noam Shizaf, the Israeli journalist, has established, and as the Israeli police have admitted, the three teens were killed right away. The Israeli government and military intelligence apparatus knew they were dead through a phone call recorded, a phone call by one of the teens to the Israeli police recorded, in which gunshots were heard. They knew who the suspects in the kidnapping and killing were, and they covered this up, held the information from the Israeli public for almost 2 weeks through a gag order, gagging the Israeli media from reporting on this, in order to justify a massive sweep through the West Bank and the beginning of the assault on the Gaza Strip. Netanyahu blamed all of Hamas for the killing, falsely implicating the entire organization. And the chaos flowed from there. It led directly after the discovery of the bodies of these three teens in a shallow grave on the property of one of the men suspected by the Israeli police less than 24 hours after the kidnapping was reported. After the discovery of these bodies, Netanyahu comes out and calls for blood vengeance at the funeral of the teens and in a statement in a cabinet meeting. Naftali Bennett makes similar statements. Ayelet Shaked from Bennett's party, the Jewish Home Party, a senior partner in Netanyahu's governing coalition, takes to Facebook to call for a genocide of Palestinians. Mobs of Jewish nationalists pour out into Jerusalem, calling for the death of Arabs. A group of men meet at one of these rallies, takes a car into occupied East Jerusalem, captures Mohammed Abu Khader, who's a 16-year-old, burns him alive, forcing him to drink gasoline, and dumps him in the woods, leading to riots in East Jerusalem. In these riots, Tariq Abu Khader, just who happened to be in town for a family wedding from Tampa, gets caught by Israeli border police and is beaten almost to death, beaten temporarily into a coma by these cops. And it was filmed, again, on closed-circuit TV, another embarrassing international incident for Israel, a human rights crime on national TV. Tariq Abu Khuder, against this backdrop of violence which flowed from the Israeli government's official manipulation, remains under house arrest in Israel. He's not charged with any crime. He is still unable to receive adequate medical care after having been beat inches from his life. And as I revealed in Alternet, his representative in Tampa, Representative Kathy Castor, has said and done nothing to support him despite aggressive lobbying campaign by his family and by the Council on American Islamic Relations. So we're seeing, again, I mean, we talked about Jerry Nadler and Charlie Rangel. Well, Kathy Castor, who receives thousands of dollars from AIPAC-related donors, apparently cares more about the feelings of Israeli police and the Israeli government than she does about the well-being of one of her constituents who's been badly abused and is being held against his will in Israel and wants to come home so he can start, get ready for a class in September.
Max Blumenthal, one quarter of those dead are children. There's been mass displacement hauled up because there is no place to evacuate to, despite what the Israeli notification of the Palestinians in Gaza is, which is get out of your neighborhoods. There's hauled up in the UNRWA, UN schools. And yet, again, we are told by the representatives of the Israeli government that it is Hamas, that it is the Gazans who are engaged in war crimes targeting civilians. So how, again, really to the American public, do we respond to those who say, but wait a minute, the war crimes are being committed by the Palestinians who are targeting civilians? What do we respond? What do we say?
Less than 30 Israelis have died in rocket attacks, and that might be 30 too many. But it's far less than who have died in peanut allergies. I mean, we're talking about since the beginning of rocket attacks. The state of Israel has killed, since the Second Intifada, one Palestinian every 3 days, and in the past week has killed with total impunity. But we have to look at the backdrop. Instead of looking at a cycle of violence or looking at, the tit-for-tat kind of trading of violence in which one side has completely disproportionate power provided with $3 billion of aid every year by the United States, we have to look at the ultimate crime, which is Israel's system of apartheid, which provides superior rights to Jews based on their religion and ethnicity, actively dispossesses Palestinians because they're not Jews in order to maintain a Jewish state. I think the real crimes are apartheid and occupation, which have been well established and are crimes under international law. It's what the U.S. is shielding Israel from facing the consequences of, and it's what Palestinians are forced to respond to with extremely inadequate means. I think any American should ask themselves what they would do if a foreign army was occupying them, dispossessing them and their families, and bombing them with impunity. I highly doubt that they would sit there with passivity. I think it would look something more like the film Red Dawn by George Milius.
You had said in your book that the situation has changed over the last few years, that things have moved to the right. How does that play into what exactly happened there, and how does that play into what's happening now?
Well, all of the elements we're seeing play out, from the right-wing death to Arabs mobs, from the right-wing government refusing ceasefire offers, from the continuing siege of Gaza and the occupation of the West Bank, all of these elements, and just the nature of the attack on Gaza, which Israel calls mowing the lawn, this kind of periodic violence that they need to initiate in order to maintain a permanent occupation. All of these elements are detailed in my book, Goliath, which begins with the Israeli assault in 2008-2009 on the Gaza Strip, and then shows how that war fueled the right-wing trends in Israeli society. And what we're looking at is the only active settler colonial state in the world with full conscription for its citizens. Everyone who turns 18 in Israel has to join the military. That means they have to be prepared in the education system to join an occupation army that is engaged in the permanent control of a restive indigenous population. So that means psychological indoctrination, demonization of the other, the implantation of existential fears through the invocation of thousands of years of Jewish oppression in small children. They're not producing people who are capable of being citizens in a democratic society. They are producing people like the young men who burned Muhammad Abu Khudair alive, and people like the young men who are executing Gazan families by remote control with drones without a second thought. It's very dangerous, and I've always said that, you know, this is the logical outcome of the philosophy of Zionism, which is a prison for Palestinian bodies and for Jewish minds. The young Jews growing up in Israel today are victims as well, but their victimhood is experienced in a psychological sense. And it's, you know, an incredibly dangerous time when you see that the state of Israel will be surrounded with walls almost completely within the next decade, and that it's covered its skies with an iron dome, this anti-rocket system, that it has become this hermetic dystopia. And 42% of its citizens reported in a recent poll that they had never even met a Palestinian. You know, a society that requires an iron dome has very limited horizons, and a society that surrounds itself with walls becomes its own prisoner. That's really the essential theme of my book, which homes in on Israeli society and shows the consequences of 47 years of occupation and 66 years of apartheid.
Max Blumenthal, we looked at the city council briefly and its stance, at least some of the members of the city council. What about the response and the role of Washington? You already said one of the legislative representatives of the young teenager who was beaten so grievously has failed to respond in any way, but the broader response by you to the politics of Washington?
You can see the entire approach of Washington to this situation in how they have responded to the kidnapping of three Israeli teens, first with a resolution declaring solidarity with Israel, and now they are working to corral $5 million of taxpayer money into a reward for information leading to the capture of the kidnapper of one of those three Israeli teens who happened to have been an American citizen. Because he had American parents. Tariq Abu Khudair, who lived in the United States, who went to high school in the United States, cannot get out of Israeli house arrest despite having been beaten inches from his life, and Congress has been totally silent about him. So you're looking at, in Israel-Palestine, a system of apartheid that provides superior rights to Israeli Jews over Palestinians because of the circumstances of their birth. This system has seeped into the American political system, as evidenced by the case of Tariq Abu Khudair and the silence of Florida's entire congressional delegation, refusal to call for his release. And finally, all of the trends that I described in this interview, these horrible trends which are leading to the presence of fascism in the streets of Israel. In Tel Aviv 2 days ago, we saw right-wing hooligans beat up small group of anti-war protesters, Jewish-Israeli anti-war protesters, including some wearing T-shirts that are familiar to the neo-Nazi far right in Europe, wearing homegrown Jewish-Israelis wearing neo-Nazi T-shirts in the streets of Tel Aviv that read, "Good night, left side." Just look up the phrase online, "Good night, left side," and you'll see it on every neo-Nazi forum. These are shirts being worn by homegrown Jewish-Israelis. All of these trends are only possible because of the U.S. special relationship with Israel. Thanks to the U.S. special relationship with Israel, the state of Israel faces no consequences for moving so far to the right and deepening its occupation and continuing to warehouse the people of Gaza. So why should young people growing up in Israel see anything wrong with supporting these right-wing elements? It's pressure on Israel through the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement that will open democratic space in Jewish-Israeli society. Once there is a price tag on occupation, those marginalized forces that were attacked in the streets of Tel Aviv will start to rise to the fore and declare, you know what, we were right, this is wrong, and we're paying a price for it. Listen to us. Until then, they will be beaten as the cops shrink away. And that's the fault of Washington, ultimately.
Max Blumenthal, are we doomed to really see a cycle of bombs every 2 years? You've talked to us about some of the underlying circumstances, the occupation itself, which is the formative process that has led to this latest catastrophe. But is it a matter of the demand collectively of go back to the 67 borders, the two-state solution, an immediate stopping of the bombing?
Well,
what should we be saying?
The two-state solution is completely over, and we should never talk about it again. Over, and it was always an attempted recipe by the center and center-left in Israel to produce Palestinian submission through a political deal. That's over. Netanyahu has come out and said that we can never give up the West Bank. The West Bank is ours forever. He said it in a speech to the nation. It's been reported in the Times of Israel. So there's no more two states. So what do? We're looking at a one-state reality. We're looking at a single apartheid state. And in that single apartheid state, the 1.7 to 2 million people in the Gaza Strip must be warehoused indefinitely. They can't be given a state, and they can't be allowed to return to their land and property that's granted to them in UN Resolution 194. And they're not going to become a part of Egypt. Same with those in the Bantustans of the West Bank. They have to be ghettoized forever. That means that Israel has to maintain its occupation as long as this system is in place. And the strategy that it employs to the Gaza Strip, it calls it, its military intelligence apparatus calls it mowing the lawn. That means every year or two, they kill a few hundred people in the Gaza Strip to weaken the Gaza government's strategic deterrence and to basically bully the population into submission. They haven't been bullied into submission. They're not going away. They're not going to forget who they are. And so as long as the status quo remains in place, we're going to keep reliving the horrors that we witnessed this week, seeing these images of children having their bodies shattered by experimental weaponry. And that's the importance of the BDS movement, the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions movement. It's to shatter the status quo. To open democratic space in Israeli society and to give the Palestinians hope that this situation can change. The only alternative to the current one-state apartheid reality is a single state, a binational state, or some kind of confederation that gives everyone equal rights regardless of race and religion.
Well, Max Blumenthal, we are going to have to leave it there for now. We have been speaking with Max Blumenthal, journalist and blogger, formerly a writer of the Daily Beast, and Al Akbar. He's the author of, and I strongly recommend that you get it, the New York Times best-selling Goliath, Life and Loathing in Greater Israel. And thank you for joining us at this very critical time and shedding additional light for the American public on what is truly happening.
Thanks for having me.
Free, free Palestine! It's my honor to introduce Remy Kenazi, who will give some powerful spoken words from Poets for Palestine.
I can't stress how important it is that we all speak out within our community, outside of our community, build a coalition and let people know that it's just not this massacre on Gaza. We have to stop the next Lebanon war, the next attack on Iran, the next attack on Gaza. This is a poem I did during the Lebanon war and the war on Gaza in 2006, and I thought it'd be appropriate. In my mind, I freed Palestine. Envisioned a dream that just needs to be seen. Olive trees in ecstasy. Orange groves that lead to our roads. No blocks filled with cops. No 10-year-old shot. Freedom is what I got. I understand my grandmother's plan to live on her bought and paid for land. And though it isn't in her hands, it remains in her heart. Every time another's killed, we go back to the start. 1948, the date they make us remember the star and scars of David. And we're the ones who've hated. We've been raped and berated by bullets and forced immigration, squatting and settling, left wrestling with the best Zionism has to offer. And while the U.S. fills its coffers, my people are seen as monsters. Our people blow up in pain, black-eyed and half insane. Wouldn't you be? if an Israeli bullet penetrated your child's brain? I envision Palestine, my mind, with a chosen, frozen in time to realize their morality's blind, to take back generations of crime and put an end to apartheid. You don't know how many kids sit and wish they could be labeled other than a terrorist. To exist is to resist streets of graffiti in their cities. Give them chalk instead of rocks. They'll use that blackboard if you let them go to school. Give them chalk instead of rocks. Instead, you bulldoze their block. Destroy their homes. Palestine is what you call the no-building zone. But you can't bulldoze our minds. Every time we'll rise through the ashes like Cassius Clay will bob and weave for infinity. There's no divinity in bombing our cities, sending up committees to treat us differently. We're from Philistine, the land where dreams are made. There's something brave about oppressing. We'll count and multiply our blessings. So remember just one thing. One day the bells of freedom will ring, and you'll see me smiling, loving life in Palestine.
Our great poet, Remy Kanazi, Free, Free Palestine.
Well, this has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.